And today we're going to be talking about the 64th, the Mahamalunkya Sutta. I'm just going to kill a little bit of time while we're getting the extra sheets printed. Won't be that long. But one of the reasons I chose this one is one of my favourite suttas. And one of the main reasons for that, it answers a question which often people ask. Is it really necessary to need jhanas to get enlightened? And you know my opinion on that, but people want to know the Buddha's opinion on that. And here we've got the clearest statement by the Buddha which answers that question. You know, what are jhanas really necessary? When are they necessary? And for what? And he gives a very, very good description of that. And he also gives a description through similes of something else which is necessary, which is some understanding of the Dhamma in order to gain enlightenment factors. And also just how enlightenment happens based on the jhanas. And the other part of this, I'm adding another sutta on the end of this, a very simple short sutta from the Sangyutta, and that's the on the sheets which are just being printed now. And the reason I'm including that was also a sutta given to the same person, Malunkya. And that particular sutta includes another well-known saying in Buddhism, which again is often misinterpreted. And I think many of you will recognize that when we reach it. And when I put these two suttas together, the Malunkyaputta Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya and the one in the Sangyutta, it makes it very, very interesting to answer the question, the place of jhanas in the path to enlightenment. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the Maha Malunkya Sutta, the Greater Discourse to Malunkyaputta. It's going to be followed by another sutta which shows that Malunkyaputta became a monk in his old age. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? Now the fetters, they're called sangyojanas, it means literally tied up with. And those fetters, the word fetter was like the ball and chain, which they used to put around prisoners, or the shackles which they would tie prisoners to a wall. That was a fetter. And in this particular metaphor, it was a fetter which tied you to the wheel of rebirth, to existence. And there were 10 fetters in all. And the first of those three fetters are overcome with screen winning. The next two are weakened by once returning, and they're fully overcome at the non-returning, the anagami stage of enlightenment, which means the five fetters are overcome by the anagami. And the last five fetters are overcome by the arahat. And there was a tricky question here, because it seemed the Malunkyaputta, he answered, and he seemed to have got them right, but the Buddha reprimanded him. So here we go. When this was said, the Venerable Malunkyaputta replied, Venerable Sir, I remember the five lower fetters as taught by the Blessed One. But, Malunkyaputta, in what way do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? Venerable Sir, I remember personality view as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. That is the view that anywhere in these five khandhas, which I talked about last time, your body, the feelings, perceptions, the mental formations, including your will and your consciousness, to think that these are a self, this is a soul in here somewhere, or these are either contained in a soul, or these contain a self or a soul, or that the self or soul owns these five khandhas. So the idea that, I'll repeat that again because it's an important point, even though it's not part of the sutta, is an important point to think like consciousness is the same as me, that I am the one who knows. Or that somehow consciousness contains a soul. Or that soul is somehow contained within consciousness. Or that somehow the soul owns and possesses as one of its functions consciousness. Or that I am the will. Or the will somehow contains the essence of me. Or the essence of me, you know, somehow contains the will. Or the essence of me, the self of the soul, owns will. That's the second, the fourth of the khandhas. Or, you know, I am the feeling. I own the feeling. I'm in the feeling. Or, you know, the feeling is within me. Now these are what is called personality view. And this stops one from being enlightened. It's the first fetter. And the second fetter, doubt, as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. And that doubt is just the usual meaning of doubt, especially doubt as to the path, doubt as to the Four Noble Truths, doubt as to the enlightenment of a Buddha. It's just general doubt, especially aimed at the truths of the teachings of the Buddha. It doesn't mean doubt about what might happen in the future and when, you know, whether the West Coast Eagles are going to win the Premiership this year or the Fremantle Dockers are going to win, that's always going to be doubtful. That doesn't mean like worldly doubt, it means, you know, the doubt about the Dhamma. And the third of those lower fetters is the adherence to rules and observances. And that is one of the three fetters which is most commonly misunderstood, especially by Western Buddhists who don't really study deeply into the teachings of the Buddha. And they think, my goodness, that means you don't have to keep any rules. And sometimes people say that when you become enlightened, you can do whatever you want. You can sleep with whoever you want, take drugs, rob banks, who cares, because you're not attached to any more rules. And that's a sign of being enlightened, which of course you all know is absolute craziness. What it means here is the, not the adherence, it's the view that enlightenment can be attained by doing practice, some sort of custom, just by keeping some types of rules, that is enough to make you enlightened. And for those of you who want to look deeper into that, in the Digha Nikaya, they give a couple of examples of that, of the dog ascetic and the cow ascetic. And the dog ascetic was a man in the time of the Buddha who thought that if you went on all fours, slept with the dogs and ate like a dog, that was such a hard thing to do. And obviously that would take a lot of going against your preferences and desires. That dog ascetic practice was enough to make you enlightened. And there was also a guy who was a cow ascetic, who again went on all fours, slept with the cows and ate grass all day. And thinking that would make him enlightened too. So if ever you've been to India, you know, you see people like that even today, doing some weird practices and thinking that's going to make them enlightened. And so when they came up to the Buddha, they said, they actually asked him, so what's going to happen? And he said, well, you're the dog ascetic, if you carry on like that, in your next life you'll be reborn as a dog. And you're the cow, and next life you'll be reborn as a cow. As you act, so you get reborn. And they weren't very impressed with that. But that's the sort of what we mean by those sorts of practices. Thinking that just like fasting is enough, or doing any sort of weird practice is enough. They need more than that. So this is just understanding the path to enlightenment. It's not as simple as just doing some sort of weird ascetic practice. So those are the first three fetters. And I remember sensual desire as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. And I remember ill will as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. Now sensual desire, I also have to mention that there's no word in English to really explain what that word sensual means, because it refers only to the desire which is bound up with the five external senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. It does not cover the sixth sense of mind. In Buddhism, they always from the very beginning had six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching and knowing, the mind. And in Buddhism, I think it must have been generally in India at that time, they made a huge separation between the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the sixth sense, the mind. And the sensual desires here means desires for those world of five senses. The sixth sense is totally separated and is not included in desire. So desire for the happiness of mind states, such as inspiration, joy, especially the deep meditations, that is specifically excluded from this. In fact, that comes up later on in the sixth and seventh fetters, as I'll mention in a few moments. And of course, ill will is a standard form of ill will, the negativity which comes up. So those are the five lower fetters. Before I go further, let's see how many of you know the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th fetters, which you overcome on the path between non-returning and full enlightenment. Anyone know the 6th fetter? Ah, come on! The 6th fetter is called Ruparaga, which is, it is the desire, the lust for the jhanas. That's the fourth fetter. The sixth fetter. The seventh fetter is the lust, the desire, the craving for the immaterial realms, arupa-raga. And the seventh fetter, sorry, that's the eighth fetter, is mana, which is like that last vestige of ego, of pride, thinking that I know I own these things. Even though the view is overcome by the time you're an anagami, by the time you're a stream winner, still there is the vestige, this of the last remnant. Just, I think they gave a simile, like, you know, you may have got your hands soiled with feces and you washed it, but there's still a little bit of a lingering smell there, which takes a while for it to totally vanish from you. That's mana. And then next, udicca, which is the restlessness, which one of the last of those hindrances to disappear. And the last one is avijja, this delusion which still lingers in the mind. But the main two for the anagami are again ruparaga, arupa-raga, which you'll see coming up in a few moments. So I say, I'll tell some people, they say, jhanas, you might get attached to them. And I said, well, that's just going to stop you getting totally enlightened. You just end up being a non-returner. And I think many of you here will be satisfied with being a non-returner at the end of this life. That'd be good enough. So it's the other attachments are the dangerous ones. Yes, Daniel. They go by themselves, these other fetters. The big one, and the reason it's there first, is this personality view. Once that is overcome, all the other ones, they unravel. Just use reason. Once you understand that all this stuff, it's not me, not mine, not a self, doesn't belong to me, it's none of my business. It means that, you know, all this sensory desire and ill will, it goes. Remember that simile of the driverless bus? Where you find that the bus has got no driver, so you stop cursing the driver for slowing down in unpleasant situations and rushing and going faster when you're having a good time. The bus driver, your will. When you realize that will is just a process, nothing to do with you, you can't control it, you stop complaining. Seeing that no self just undermines sort of all this desire and ill will. Who can I get angry at? There's no one in there. It's just like shouting at an empty bus driver's seat. A total waste of time. So you stop it. You stop all this desire and ill will. So after you become the stream winner, you see there's no self. Desire and ill will, they just fade away. Remember, that's desire for the world of the five senses. And then you become the non-returner. But you have this beautiful desire for these states of mind in the jhanas. And that's just the last little thing which stops you totally disappearing. There's hardly anything left at all, but there's still that tiny bit. And when you let go of the jhanas, and you can see later on in the sutta they show you how to do that, then everything is gone. So the big one is the first one. But the way that Mallunkyaputta answered was actually pretty accurate. And the Buddha reprimands him, "Mallunkyaputta, to whom do you remember my having taught these five lower fetters in that way?" That must have surprised many people, because I'm sure most of the monks would say, "What's wrong with that?" And in my little book, I did a notice here. Usually when the Buddha would reprimand somebody because they did something wrong, they'd actually call them Mogha Purusa. It was like a term of just, you know, naughty monk or stupid. And I've noted that he didn't say this in this one, because he wasn't stupid. The Buddha was, this wasn't really a reprimand. He was just saying, "Yes, but let's go deeper into this." He said, "Would not wanderers of other sects confute with the simile of the infant? For a young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of personality, of me. That sense of self develops, later on in the infancy. So how could a personality view arise in him? Now therefore he should be a stream winner, at least a baby." That's obviously ridiculous. And the Buddha's pointing out, yet the underlying tendency to personality view lies within that infant. And the commentary says, and this is quite reasonable, that Mallunkyaputta thought that, when these five fetters are there, they're a problem, but sometimes they're gone, and when they're gone, you're an anagami. He didn't realize it's the underlying tendency. They can be suppressed, especially by things like jhana, but they haven't been overcome yet. So the Buddha was saying, it's not just these things if you can't see them, it's the underlying tendency for these things to come up again. And that's the important point there. So that's what the Buddha was saying. Yes, you may have got some jhanas, but they're still lying underneath there. You've got to go a little bit deeper to overcome them totally. A yonder tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of teachings of Dhamma. So how could doubt about these teachings arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency to doubt lies within that infant. A young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion, rules. So how could adherence to rules and observances arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency to adherence to rules and observances lies within them. A young, tender infant lying prone doesn't even have the notion, sensual pleasures. So how could sensual desire arise in him? Yet the tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion, beings. So how could ill will towards beings arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency to ill will lies within him. Would not the wanderers of other sects confute you with the simile of the infant? Because the infant would be like a non-returner. Thereupon the Venerable Ananda said, because he realized there was something going on, "It is a time, Blessed One, it is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to teach the five lower fetters. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it." So he wanted to realize, even Ananda realized, that he didn't really understand totally what the Buddha was saying here. So the Buddha gave a very deep simile, the very deep teachings of the five lower fetters. "Then listen, Ananda, and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied, and the Blessed One said this. And here we go with the real teachings of this sutta. "Hear, Ananda, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma." So this is just a standard definition for someone who's not a stream winner yet. "Abides with a mind obsessed and enslaved by personality view." And lovely way it says obsessed and enslaved, because it's an enslavement. It's like being in a jail, thinking we exist. And it is an obsession. This obsession because we always want to affirm our existence. We want to show that we are. It is an obsession and an enslavement. Very beautiful words. "And they don't understand, as it actually is, the escape from the original personality view. And when the personality view has become habitual and is eradicated in him, it becomes a lower fetter. They abide with a mind obsessed and enslaved by doubt, by adherence to rules and observances, by sensual lust and by ill will, and they do not understand as it actually is, the escape from arisen ill will. And when that ill will has become habitual and is eradicated in them, it is a lower fetter. So when these things arise, they don't see them as a danger, they just don't know what to do with it. And so these things keep on growing. Like the last one, the ill will. And sometimes, you know, you get angry. Number one, you've got to realize it's a danger. It's a thing which is going to cause many problems and much pain to ourselves and others. So first of all, we understand that any thought or feeling or words of anger are a danger to us and other people. And then we have to know the escape from that ill will. What should we do so it doesn't continue in us for that long? And of course, you know, that those of you who come here on a Friday night give many talks on how to overcome ill will. Obviously, the greatest way of overcoming ill will is just compassion. And a little contemplation, such as, you know, they've done something really, really bad to me, but I don't have to have ill will, because karma will get the bastards anyway, as I keep on saying. So that's not real. We just whatever I have, I'm not going to get angry at you. You're going to get it. Or as somebody else says, wow, if that's what they've done to you, you only have to be with them for a few minutes. And they have to live with themselves 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of their lives. Poor things having to put up with such a mind like that. You just can walk away, so you're very lucky. So that gives you compassion. They must be really suffering to do such things to you. So instead of having ill will, you have this wonderful kindness instead. These are ways of escape. And of course, there's so many of them. I could go on for a long time on that. So you understand. So an untaught ordinary person doesn't know how to escape from these things, doesn't even know the danger. However, the well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, who has regard for true ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, these are the stream winners, they do not abide with a mind obsessed and enslaved by personality view. They understand it as it actually is. The escape from the original personality view and personality view together with the underlying tendency to it is abandoned in them. So they just don't have personality view. They do not abide with a mind obsessed and enslaved by doubt, by adherence to rules and rituals, by sensual lust, by ill will. They understand as it actually is, escape from the arisen ill will, together with the underlying tendency to its abandoned. Sorry, they understand as it actually is, the escape from the arisen ill will, and ill will, together with the underlying tendency to it, is abandoned. So this is not just like an infant, where there's no ill will there and the underlying tendency is still there. This is even the underlying tendency is gone. It won't come up again. And I just gave you an idea there that it's easy to have strategies to overcome ill will, but this is where the ill will just will not come up. And the reason is because you've seen no self. Now, here we get something very interesting. And this is the part of the sutta which I really like to quote a lot. There is a path, Ananda, a way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. How they were overcome, how to be an anagami, a non-returner. That anyone without coming to that path, to that way, shall know or see or abandon the five lower fetters, that is not possible. So this is what the Buddha says, an only way. Read it out. There is a path that anyone without coming to that path, to that way, shall know or see or abandon five lower fetters. That's not possible. To make it even more clear, just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is not possible that anyone should cut out its heartwood without cutting through its bark and sapwood. So too there is a path, a way, to the abandoning of the five lower fetters, that anyone without coming to that path, to that way, shall know or see or abandon the five lower fetters, that is not possible. So when I first read that, I thought, okay, let's be smart. There is a tree. How can you actually get to the pith, to the heartwood, without going through the bark and sapwood? So I thought maybe digging a hole and going up through the roots. But you know, now that still has to go through some some bark and sapwood. Even the roots have got this bark and sapwood on them. And you thought and thought, and there's no way. You have to go through the bark and sapwood to get to the pith of a tree. So please remember that. So this is an only way. Suppose, Ananda, simile number two, the river Ganges were full of water right up to the brim so that crows could drink from it. You know, because crows can't swim, so they need to stand on something. They stand on a bank, and then they can actually drink from it. Full of water right to the brim so that crows could drink from it. And then a feeble man came thinking, by swimming across the stream with my arms, I shall get safely across the further shore of this river Ganges. Yet he would not be able to get safely across. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of personality, for the ending of the self-view, if his mind does not enter into it, and this is a saying here, acquires confidence, steadiness and decision, then he could be regarded as like a feeble man. The real translation of that, which I've mentioned I think a couple of weeks ago, this is something which comes up very often. It is, I know the Pali by heart, it's Pakandati, Santitati, Pasadati, and Vimuti, Vimuchati. And these are words mean that you leap into it, you have confidence is fine, happiness in this, you remain in it and you get freedom. The word decision here is just a wrong translation. Now, important to Bhikkhu Bodhi many times, but he refuses to change it. But it's, he agrees that it's right, but he refuses because he did it once and that's it. So too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of personality, if the mind does not leap into that idea of non-self, find joy in it, remain in it, get steadiness in it, and then find release with that idea, then they're like a feeble man. And this is a powerful point, because I've been teaching for such a long time. Sometimes when you teach non-self, instead of leaping into it, people recoil from that teaching. They just don't want to hear it. Because it is a frightening teaching. Certainly I remember as a youth, the most scary part of any horror movie would not be when the demon or the vampire came to kill you. It's when they came and said, I'm going to take your soul. And now, because of that Christian tradition, the idea of the devil taking your soul was the worst possible calamity of any other calamities. These days, if a devil came up and said, I'll take your soul, I say, you can have it. There's nothing in there. You've got a bum deal. But what it does is it scares a person. Because this is the most intimate possession of yourself, you. So the idea, the very thought that there's no one in there, is for some people terrifying. It's something you have to get used to. And the more you come and listen to monks like me, the more you get used to it. And the more you realize, actually, this is not such a bad idea after all. So after a while, the mind actually leaps onto it. And finds actually not fear, but joy in the idea there's no one in there. And then that idea steadies in them. And that produces a great sense of freedom. There's four qualities here. Of Pakandati, Pasidati, Santitati, Vimuchati. And those four words actually reappear many, many times. So for a person who doesn't leap onto that idea, they are feeble, they can't cross the stream. So how can you actually get that idea of leaping into it? Listening to a lot of Dhamma, having experience. And then there's scientists. You know, scientists keep on saying there's no self in there, no soul in there. You ask any scientist, you ask any Richard Dawkins or Chris Hitchens, and they'll say, yeah, there's no self, there's no God. Scientists know that. But that's not the point. They think they exist. They are. They still have the illusion of a self. Very, very strong. Intellectually, they know. But sort of inherently, emotionally, they are. And it's a very difficult thing to let go of that. So, the reason is there. And now we just need to be able to leap into it and find joy in it. And then you become not the feeble person, but the strong person. Suppose, Ananda, the river Ganges were full of water right up to the brim so that crows could drink from it. And then a strong person came thinking, by swimming across the stream with my arms, I shall get safely across to the further shore of this river Ganges. And they would be able to get safely across. So too, when the Dharma is being taught to someone for the cessation of personality, if their mind leaps into it, it's not just enters, it literally means jumps into it. Wow, this is good. And acquires not just confidence, but joy. Passidati is a word which not, it does mean confidence, because when you find joy and you settle into it, you like it. But it's more than just confidence, it's a sense of happiness therein. Wow, this feels good. And then, steadiness, that's okay. And not decision, that means absolute nonsense. And you find release with that state. Then you could be regarded as like a strong man, a strong woman, an athlete. So that's where your view, your understanding of Dharma is good enough that when you hear non-self, you can actually leap into it. You're not afraid. You don't sort of recoil from this idea of non-self. And in all those years of teaching, you see that even monks, the most of non-self they can accept, but there's always that tiny bit which people keep holding on to. Yeah, we can understand the body's not self, but surely there's something inside of me which is self. Yeah, okay, the will, I can understand, I can let go of the will, or the consciousness, that consciousness without will which merges with the ultimate. And you find so many little places where monks, they don't leap fully into non-self. They just keep something back, which means they can never be free. Nothing is just nothing at all. Yeah, when you pass over to another life, that's just another life. Then you still keep getting reborn. Well, this is just like a metaphor of an electrical field. Any electrician won't be able to notice anything whatsoever at all, but it's a great simile, like a force, a current. Stream of consciousness, called the Buddha, said the Buddha, going from one life to another. But when you see non-self, that stream of consciousness, it stops, empty. Nothing to keep it going. The generator is turned off. The batteries are dead. Nothing works. There we go. So, this means that's an important part of what's coming next. To have that enough inclination to Dhamma, enough understanding, enough exposure to these teachings, that when non-self comes up, you leap to it. You're not afraid. At least you're not scared too much by it, that you can actually enter it and find, wow, this is great. Now, what, Ananda, is that path, that way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters? Remember, this is the path that anyone not coming to that path, that way, they shall know or see abandon five lower fetters. That's not possible. No more than you get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the sapwood. So what is that path? The only path to overcoming the five lower fetters. Here, with the seclusion from the objects of attachment, with the abandoning of unwholesome states, with the complete tranquilization of bodily inertia, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk, nun, meditator enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by moving the mind onto and holding onto the object with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. First jhana. And as you can see, second, third, fourth jhana, and the immaterial attainments as well. That anyone, without coming to this path, can cut the five, abandon the five fetters is impossible. You've got the answer here. This is the clearest answer for anyone, that you need jhanas at least to become an anagami. You cannot become an anagami without the jhanas. Read it again if you wish. Now also, it gives a little bit more detail about jhanas again, the first jhana. Secluded from objects of attachment. Sometimes that's why it's great to go on a retreat to jhana growth. Objects of attachment, your home, your car, your wife, your family, your husband. Sometimes those things, if in the middle of the house, sometimes it's hard because even almost like the smell, the echo of all those things is there with you. So you've got to be really secluded from those things. With the complete tranquilization of bodily inertia, now that stiffness of the body, that's what I was saying actually yesterday afternoon. That the happiness, the inspiration, the joy, if you can develop that before you meditate, the body feels like free. It's not so sluggish, and it's not like trying to drag yourself, you know, into the meditation. The mind sort of goes very quickly into deep, peaceful states. And I think you can get the idea. The word inertia is a very wonderful translation of this Pali word. You know how hard it is sometimes you want to drag yourself into the meditation state. You just doesn't want to go. It's just the inertia, the sluggishness there. That's abandoned. And the best way of abandoning that is happiness, joy, inspiration. That's the best way of overcoming that inertia. And secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. Mentioned that before. It's not sensual pleasures here, it's the five senses. Ajahn Bhumari was on that point recently. Pali word with karma in the plural means the five senses. So it should really mean, say, secluded from the five senses. Secluded from unwholesome states means the five hindrances. So if you did a really accurate translation, said quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from the five hindrances, monk, nun, layperson enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied no thought in jhanas. This is the movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Born of seclusion from what? Seclusion from the five senses. Five senses are no longer there. Like a great burden, a huge burden has been lifted from you. Oh, you feel so free. It's so nice to be free of five senses. I don't have to worry about this body and seeing and thinking and all that sort of stuff. Oh, this is so nice, so peaceful. It's like going on holiday, big time. It's bliss.
Could you elaborate on why thinking is included underneath the five sensual pleasures?
Because there's karma and karma vitaka. When karma vitaka is like the thoughts around the sense pleasures, around the five senses. So if you look at your thinking mind, just 99.9% of your thinking mind is concerned with the world of the five senses, especially when you don't even know the jhana realm. So it is, even you think you might be thinking about jhanas, but it's not jhanas you're thinking about, it's another form of like five sense-like pleasures. So much of the thinking which we go is really rooted in the five sense world. Even Dharma concepts is all five sense stuff. Because you haven't really seen that Dharma concept yet, especially not the mind. And I'll elaborate on that. There's a sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya which says the obstacles to samadhi. And they've got the coarse, the medium, the refined, and the lingering obstacle, the last obstacle before you get the stillness. And that is Dhamma vitaka, which is thoughts about Dhamma. And that's a brilliant teaching of the Buddha, because you get to a stage in meditation, the mind is clear, the hindrances are very weak, and so you can actually think about the Dhamma very clearly. And it's like you can give yourself the most amazing Dhamma discourse. And that happens to people. They get into a state of meditation, and then the Dhamma is really clear, and they can have amazing insights. And the Buddha said, that is an obstacle. And I remember when I first taught that, the monks afterwards went to the library to check it out. It didn't make any sense to them. But it was there. And what happens is that Dhammavitaka, the thoughts of Dhamma just before you get into the meditation, that's almost like, you know, the last trick of Mara to stop you getting into jhana. Give you something to think about, give you a sweetie to stop you going all the way. It's a bribe. Because you haven't got the data yet to really understand the Dhamma. And it sounds good, it feels good, but it's not the real thing. So even though you get some great insights just before the jhanas, it's Dhammavitaka, thinking about Dhamma, but it is obstacle, said the Buddha. It's in the Anguttara threes. Yes. What is going on there is that it could be a stream winning, but it means that there's more to go yet. Or if it is an enlightenment experience, such as when Bahiya heard the teachings of the Buddha, then there's something more behind that which will be revealed later on this afternoon. That's why I got the second piece in. But, okay, so this is the first jhana, and you've got the second, third, fourth, and immaterial jhanas coming next, or immaterial attainments. But the Buddha pauses here to let the person know how you can go from that first jhana experience, you know, where a person will get anagami maybe, and take it even further to full enlightenment. But whatever exists therein of material form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, in that jhana experience, he sees even those, this very refined stuff, as impermanent, suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as not self. That's a tough thing to do. Because the first time you get into jhana, wow! Oh, this is so nice. This is so wonderful. I think I said 2 weeks ago, Christian saints who maybe get first jhana, they take that as union with God. They don't look upon that as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as non-self. They take that as God. Pure love. It's very understandable that that can happen. But if you've had these teachings of the Buddha, even that incredible first jhana, impermanent, suffering, disease, a tumor, a barb, is a calamity, an affliction, is alien, is disintegrating, is void, is not self. And you turn the mind away, even from the jhana, and direct it towards the real deathless element, simile for nibbana. This is the peaceful, this is the sublime, that is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, not just outside, but inside too. Dispassion, or destruction of craving. Dispassion, or there's another alternative word there, fading away. Cessation. Lingering cessation, don't go too fast. Nibbana. Full cessation. Like the simile of the flame being extinguished. Flame hasn't gone anywhere. It's just nothing there to begin with. Now the flame has just been extinguished. Gone. That is nibbana, its meaning. This is the peaceful, this is the sublime, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments. The destruction of craving, fading away. Stopping, cessation, nibbana, the flame gone out. Standing upon that, that idea of what the ultimate is, that these things, even the first jhana, is suffering, it's a barb, it's a tumor, it's an affliction. And this is the real stillness, where everything goes. They attain the destruction of the outflowings, the taints. But if you don't attain the destruction of the outflowings, then because of the desire for that Dharma, the first jhana, because of the delight in that Dharma, the first jhana, the bliss of it. With the destruction of the five law fetters, you become one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana, without ever returning from that world. This is a path, the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. So, the Buddha is saying that once you get that, if you can look upon those things as disease, as a tumor, and turn away from that state, go to the death state, then if you can also abandon the delight in the jhana, then it's full enlightenment. If you still linger with the delight in the jhana, then that's being the non-returner, the anagami. What happens to the anagami when they die? Because they have just one attachment left. It's not an attachment to the world of the five senses, so there's no point to come back to this world anymore. They never come back here. They go to the what's called the Sudhavasa, the pure abodes, and in those states, getting in and out of jhana whenever they want, because that's their delight, in a mind-made realm, and eventually from there. They never come back again. Sooner or later, sometimes it takes many, many eons sometimes, but they let go of that delight in the jhanas and disappear forever. That is the anagami realm. The other ones which are going to come up are very similar. So before I pause for some questions, again with the stilling of the movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, no thought, the meditator enters upon the abides in the second jhana. With the fading away as well of the rapture, the meditator enters upon the abides in the third jhana. With the abandoning of the pleasure and pain and the mental pleasure and pain, the meditator enters upon the abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mind plus due to equanimity. So now, this same refrain goes with all of these four jhanas. Whatever exists therein of material form, feeling, perception, formations and consciousness, they see that those states as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumour, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as not self. And you turn your mind away from those states, even from the fourth jhana, and direct it towards the death of sediment. This is the real peace. This is pretty peaceful, fourth jhana. Gee, it's incredible stillness. But this is the real peaceful. This is the real sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, even that jhana state. Still consciousness there. Stilling even that. The relinquishing of all attachment, destruction of all craving, this fading away, cessation, even the jhana fading. Nibbana, going out. Standing upon that, they attain the destruction of the taints. If you don't attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for that Dharma, in this case fourth jhana, and delight in that Dharma, destruction of the five lower fetters, become one due to appear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and then there attain final Nibbana, without ever returning from that world. And this is the path, the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. Now the interesting here, you have three of the immaterial states, but not the fourth. Again, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, this is based on the fourth jhana, just going deeper, with not attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is unlimited, I don't say infinite, the meditator enters upon and abides in the base of unmeasured space. Whatever exists therein of feeling, perception, formations and consciousness, there's no form here, so that's why that particular aggregate or khanda is missing. You see those states as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumour, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as non-self. You turn your mind away from even the first immaterial state and direct it towards the real deathless element. Thus, this is the perceivable, this is the sublime, that is the stilling of all formations, relinquishing of all attachment, destruction of craving, fading away, cessation, nibbana. Standing upon that, they attain the destruction of the outflowings, the asavas. But if they don't attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for the Dharma, that delight in the Dharma, the destruction of the five lower fetters, they become one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and they attain final nibbana, without ever returning from that world. This is the path, the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. or again by completely surmounting the base of infinite or unmeasured space. And if you remember, just the way I explained that, for those of you who have meditated in present moment, awareness is like unmeasured time. Unmeasured time means you look at it one way, it's infinite, you've got as much time as you ever want when you're really in the present moment. And looking another way, there's no time at all. What's happening here is because that thing is not being measured, it's about to disappear. Its meaning is gone when you stop measuring it. So in all these ones, space, consciousness, is a disappearing of these whole concepts. Vanishing just from your mind. This is more disappearing happening. So you're aware conscious infinity is unmeasured. The mind enters upon abides in the base of unmeasured consciousness. And again, whatever exists therein, of feeling, perception, formation, consciousness, he sees those states as impermanence, suffering, etc. You turn away from those states. And if you still have delight in that immaterial state, you'll become an anagami. If you don't have any delight in it at all, you're parinibbana, you attain nibbana, full arahat. And again, by completely surmounting the base of unmeasured consciousness, just with a perception of nothingness, there is nothing, the meditator enters the pod and abides in the base of nothingness. Whatever exists therein of feeling, perception, formations and consciousness, they see these states as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a barb, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as not self. They turn their mind away from those states and direct it towards the deathless element, nuts. This is the peaceful. This is the sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, fading away, cessation stopping, and nirvana disappearing, totally gone, poof. Standing upon that, you attain the destruction of the taints. If you do not attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for that Dhamma, that delight in that Dhamma, the third immaterial state, with the destruction of the five law fetters, you become one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and never attain final nibbana, without ever returning from that world. This is the path, the way to the abandoning of the five law fetters. They don't mention the fourth immaterial, neither perception nor non-perception. The reason they don't mention that is because it's such a refined state that there's hardly anything to stand upon. It's just too refined. So in here the Buddha says, don't use that as a base for gaining that sort of understanding of total cessation. And anyway, you're just so close to entering into Nirodha Samapatti, which is a cessation of everything anyway, just go that last step. But there, it's not mentioned because it's too refined to use as an object of standing on to get to the deathless. Yes. Okay, what happens is once you've got into that state, within any of those jhanas or immaterial states, you can't do anything whatsoever. Such contemplations cannot exist. But when you come out afterwards, wow, what was that? That was really beautiful. That was amazing. And there, if you've had the teachings of the Buddha, so you are like the strong person. Now you don't recoil from non-self or suffering or impermanence. You can leap into it. You notice at that state, much of what you took yourself to be has disappeared. In that state, for example, will has gone. You understand, in that state, much of consciousness has gone. So you don't recoil, you see that actually cessation is possible. You understand what this thing about cessation and things disappearing and stopping really is, because much has already stopped. Enough has vanished within the first jhana for you to, as they say in science, extrapolate what happens when everything else stops. Number one, you see it can stop. enough of your idea of self has vanished to be able to see the rest can go to. Standing on that. That is the true deathless. That is the true peace. That is the true bliss. When everything is gone, then you can attain to the state of anagami or arahat. It's much easier the deeper the jhanas are, because you just experience more things vanishing. You get into some of the immaterial states, and say there's hardly anything left anyway. So, you know, it has to be very, very hard for a person, unless they're a feeble person, and they recoil, you know, from what they've just experienced. They don't jump into the obvious meaning of having just had most of all of your will and most of your consciousness totally fade away. And anatta is so obvious, but if you recall from that, you're a feeble man, you can't cross. But if you had enough teachings of Buddhism, enough teachings, enough understanding, you see that there's nothing there, and you jump. You'll accept. And there you'll find the joy and confidence. There you'll steady yourself in that long enough to find the release from those fetters. Does that answer your question? Directing towards the deathless, what happens is, you know, the soul, this is because you've been brainwashed, because you listen to this, you leap towards it. It's an automatic sort of just happens because of all the things you've heard, you've learned, you've discussed, you become a strong woman. So you leap towards that. You're not afraid, then you're strong enough to cross. So you need that degree of exposure to the Dhamma to create that strength. So you leap towards it, you find joy in the teachings. Hear this and think, wow, this is amazing stuff, this is good. Sometimes people hear these teachings and they walk out the door, it's just too much. They can't take it. Yeah. It's an automatic process, the mind leaps in. It's not, you don't decide. This is not one of those things like most people do. Okay, this is what I have to do to become enlightened. There's nothing to do with you. The I disappears. This is just what happens. You're exposed to these teachings and the mind leaps to it. You know, you can't stop it. It just happens. It's totally involuntary. The letting go is you don't let go. Letting go happens. The mind leaps to emptiness. It leaps to freedom. It just recognizes something and you can't stop it. Comes later on. Not in this sutta. The threefold knowledge. That is knowledge of past lives, knowledge of the law of karma, knowledge of the liberation, because that doesn't happen to everybody. Some monks get the Te Ouija, enlightened ones, not just monks, some don't get the Te Ouija, the three knowledges. There's still arahats. That's really rare, it's usually the best way. But in this particular case it just shows this, yeah, it's nice because you get a much more understanding of suffering if you can recognize the past lives and karma. But herein you're going more on a way of... That's actually, it almost comes up a bit later on, in the last paragraph I haven't mentioned yet. Yeah? Okay, yeah. Now remember, this is outside of this sutta. This is asking the question, is it really necessary to get jhana to be a stream winner? This particular sutta doesn't answer that question. It just answers the question, you need jhana to become a non-returner. And I mention that because some of you will have heard something called a Sukha Vipassika, a dry insight meditator. This comes from the commentaries, never in the suttas at all. Not one place is that mentioned. And this is claimed that you can become an arahat, fully enlightened, without any jhanas. And I really sort of say that is wrong, and I usually quote this sutta as showing quite clearly it cannot happen. So at the very least, the very minimum, you need jhanas to be a non-returner. And also obviously to be an arahat. When it comes to be a stream winner, it is no more of a question of interpretation. So I cannot quote anything. Well, there's actually one place in the suttas, but it's only one place. And it's not strong enough to convince people. This is strong enough to convince people. Where it says that without right view, so without jhanas you can't get right view. But that's only a small place, and it's just too difficult to quote that. Personal experience is I can't see how it is possible to become a stream winner without jhanas. So when you have people who do become stream winners without jhanas, the most amazing case, which I don't mind quoting because I can't understand how on earth this happened. There were the assassins who went to kill the Buddha. In that story, when Devadatta and King Ajatasattu wanted to sort of take over, they hired assassins to kill the Buddha. Later on, they let Nalagiri sort of loose and try and trample the Buddha. But before they did that, they had assassins, and they sent one person to kill the Buddha, two people to kill that one assassin, four people to kill the two killers of the assassin, eight to kill the four, 16 to kill the eight, and 32 to kill the 16, to try and make it just too difficult to trace back who killed who. And it was just a way of just confusing the forensic team. But when the first man went there to try and kill the Buddha, he saw the Buddha and he was just too much metta, too soft, too nice. He just, I can't kill someone like this. And so he bowed to the Buddha and said, please forgive me, I just came to kill you. And the Buddha said, yeah, I forgive you. And then he taught him the Dhamma. And this guy became a stream winner. Now, that really sort of challenges any statement from monks like me who say you need jhana to become a stream winner, because assassins don't do jhanas. But there was a case of an assassin. He wasn't even a Buddhist. He was a killer, a murderer. Came up to the Buddha, and when he left, was a stream winner. Now that's really sort of quite impressive. And sometimes I wonder whether that was actually not real, added later on, because it doesn't make any sense to me, but that's what it says. But it could be, and this is my interpretation, in the suttas they make very little distinction between someone on the path to being a stream winner and actually attaining stream winning. And someone on the path to being a stream winner, there's two types of persons on the path to being a stream winner. One is called a sadanusari, the one who follows on faith. They've got so much faith. They've got so much faith in the Buddha that what the Buddha says, they're going to practice. They're going to do it because they're ultimate faith. And the other one is a dhammanusari, the one who has actually some understanding. And the dhammanusari, I said, is the one who has the jhanas. The sadhanasari is just have faith. And those sorts of people who went to see the Buddha and were so inspired, such as those assassins, I would say that, yeah, they could have become sadhanasaris on the path to being a stream winner. And when it said they attained stream winning, what they really meant was they attained the path of stream winning, which is so, it is certain that before you die, you'll become the full stream winner once you're on the path. It's like, who was that guy who was got killed in Melbourne jail the other day? One of those mobsters who says, you've sneaked on the police, you're a dog, you're dead, John Treasure. And they say you're dead. What do you mean I'm dead? I'm alive, I'm talking. What do they mean? Your death is certain. So even in the English language you say you're dead, which means your death is certain. And it's exactly the same in Pali. You're a stream winner. I'm not a stream winner, yeah, but it's certain. And I think that's one of the reasons for those confusions. Their stream winning is so certain, but it hasn't happened yet. So it's a bit convoluted, but it's a good point. Aha, at the time of death, is it without jhanas? It's almost like a pseudo jhana at death. What do I mean by pseudo jhana at death? You're secluded from the five senses, the eyes, ears, smell, taste, touch, stop. You see the nimitta, the beautiful light which people go towards. It's a pseudo jhana experience. You know, it's almost like you get like a freebie jhana at death. And it's like the free gift which comes with every cornflakes box. With death, you always get this free opportunity. You've got the sort of the nimitta there, five senses, the body totally disappeared. You've got the opportunity there to have a jhana experience. And that's why I say that you've got an incredible chance there, five senses of God. You're free from those five senses. It's a pseudo jhana type. It's not real jhana, but pseudo. Make sense? Oh, yeah. You can use that experience as long as you are a strong man or woman who's not feeble so they can actually cross to the other shore. In other words, you don't recoil from the fact that you don't exist, of non-self. Yeah. You've got a really good chance. You've got another chance, a big one. That's encouraging, isn't it? Especially for your oldies who are going to go soon. But again, go back to that beautiful simile of just like the weak man and the strong man. And to be able to cross, the weak person is someone who recoils from these teachings. No, there's no such thing as non-self. Just I want God, I want to be, I want to get reborn, I want to do this, I want to do that. So if you recoil from that, it's a waste of time. The jhana at death, you won't get anywhere. But if you leap towards it, then you're getting somewhere. You got the opportunity, and you grab it. Oh yeah, there's many examples. This one of the best ones is Sarakani, and he happens twice in the Sanghita Nikaya because he was an alcoholic. And when he died, you know, at that time people were asking because you know, he used to go and listen to the Buddha teach, and they asked, "Oh, this Sarakani, when did he get reborn?" And he said, "Oh no, he was a stream winner." And the village said, "What, him? He was a drunkard." You know, they said, it's just, this is classic, happens in all cultures and all ages. Oh, these days anyone can become the stream winner. Just people aren't like the good old days. You know, kids today, they're not like kids in our day. You know, and so police today, governments today, in the good old days. And that's what they were saying, just now, these days anyone can become a stream winner. And he's a drunkard. Standards are slipping. And it was a problem. I mean, how could he become a stream winner when he was a drunkard? Except at that time of death, he leaped towards the Dhamma. He knew the word of the Buddha, and even though he couldn't quite do it in this life, too many sort of attachments, especially to the bottle, at time of death, he did it. Okay, another guy. Who was it? It was a Channa, and he got really sick, and he thought he was enlightened. He decided to kill himself, commit suicide. And when he cut his throat, he realized fear and pain, and he realized, "I'm not an arahat." Ah! And he was dying there. But he'd heard the teachings, he leapt towards the Dhamma, and he just made it before he died. Not a recommended path. Okay, so we go to the last paragraph here before we go into the other page. And this is Ananda saying, made it very clear, brilliant teachings there. You need to have that strength, that familiarity with the Buddha's teachings, especially with things like non-self and suffering, to be leap towards it. And then you get any of these jhanas, those two together, there's a good chance that you'll overcome the five fetters. And that's the only path. Just like you can't get to the heartwood of a tree except by going through that path. In the same way, you cannot overcome the five lower fetters without those jhanas or immaterial states. Lalanda said, "Venerable Sir, if this is the path, the way to the abandonment of the lower fetters, then how is it that some monks here are said to gain deliverance of mind and some are said to gain deliverance of by wisdom?" You know, this they call like Cheta Vimutti and Panya Vimutti. And Cheta Vimutti is more like, you know, the jhanas. Panya Vimutti, you know, it's wisdom, insight. And all the Buddha says, the difference here, Ananda, is in their faculties, I say. You know, whether one is, you know, the wisdom faculty is strong or the stillness faculty is strong, it's very similar to the Dhammanusari and the Sadhanusari. The one who goes because of the experience, the one who goes on faith. But the only difference is again, with the Tewija, with the ones who just got very, very strong wisdom, but not so strong of stillness, they can become enlightened. They still have to get the jhanas, but they don't get sort of the power such as remembrance of past lives and the knowledge of how rebirth happens between lives. They don't get that knowledge. They've got strong wisdom, but not the strong mind to get to those insights. Others, they've got the strong mind and the wisdom, and they can actually get those insights too. Differences of faculties. A good example of that, it's not quite the same, but someone's asking me today, and they say, well, you know, if a person takes a long time getting enlightened, you know, they have a hard time doing the jhanas, and they struggle, they eventually make it, they become wise people. Just in the same way that, you know, you go from, say, serpentine to Perth, you keep getting lost on that way. It takes a long time to get there, but you really know all the back roads, you know sort of, you know, where not to go. You know, you become very wise. But if a person just goes and they just get straight to Nibbana, yeah, they know how to get there, but they're not really so clear about, you know, all the mistakes which ordinary people make. They never made those mistakes themselves, so, you know, their wisdom is not that strong. So faculties, the Cheta Vimutti, and that was someone like Moggallana, powerful mind, and Sariputta, who took a much longer time because his meditation was not that good, and he didn't have any psychic powers, but he was the wisest. He made so many mistakes, you might say, you know, went down so many wrong sort of alleys, that he became this really wise teacher. So, difference of faculties. Yes. Yeah. It can be a sense of surrender, because that is the word which I didn't mention in passing. Just say a Christian mystic who got into the first jhana would not be able to see it as a tumor, as a dad, as non-self. They take that as the ultimate, as God, as union with God. But the reason why they would get into those states is because they do surrender their self to God. They do let go of a lot, which means they can get that far, but they can't surrender God. They surrender self, but don't surrender anything else. So that's one of the reasons you can't get deeper there. That's why non-self and no God go together, surrender both, give up everything, and then you can get enlightened. Leap is when a person is just attracted to it. It's just like sort of, you know, like mangoes fall to the ground. When they're ripe, they leap to the ground. No decision is made there. It is this natural attraction to non-self. But there is that idea of like moving there. You hear it. It's just like sometimes Look, this personal experience, I'm sure many of you have had this experience. First time I saw a monk, just my mind leapt to it. This was really important. That was an amazing experience. You saw it, and wow! Just, you know, straight away, but physically, you just went towards that being. Because it was important. I didn't know why. It wasn't a decision, you just did it. And sometimes some of you, the first time you sort of listen to some Dharma, just straight, it gets you. You leap towards it, you get into it. And it's important when your meditation gets going, when your mind gets starts still and peaceful, when a bit of peace comes up in your meditation, the mind just goes for it. You can't stop it. Anyway, the last part is another Malankyaputta Sutta, and that is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and because I didn't ask you to bring this, I copied this out for you. This is from the Salayatana Sanyutta, and this is another Malankyaputta Sutta. Then the Venerable Malankyaputta, the same guy we were talking about before, approached the Blessed One and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." "Hear now, Malankyaputta, what should I say to the young monks, when a monk like you, old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, ask me for an exhortation in brief?" In other words, it's almost like lazy. You know, you're a senior guy, you know, you should know more than that. You know, people always want the fast path to enlightenment. Sometimes people come and ask me that. "Look, I can't stay for a whole hour and a half like today. You know, I'm a busy person. Can you please tell me, you know, how to meditate in brief and teach me the Dhamma in brief? Come on, so I can actually go back. I haven't got time for all these 9-day retreats." So sometimes you just can't do that. And the Malankyaputta said, "Look, although, Venerable Sir, I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma in brief, let the Fortunate One teach me the Dhamma in brief, perhaps I may understand the meaning of the Blessed One's statements, perhaps I may become an heir to the Blessed One's statement." Okay, what do you think, Malankyaputta? Do you have any desire, lust or affection for those forms cognizable by the eye that you have not seen and never seen before, that you do not see and would not think might be seen in the past, present and future, okay? This is sights that haven't you in the past, don't see now, and not be seen in the future. "No, Venerable Sir. Do you have any desire, lust or affection for the sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, tastes cognizable by the tongue, tactile objects cognizable by the body, for those mental phenomena cognizable by the mind, the six senses now, that you have not cognized and never cognized before, that you do not cognize and would not think might be cognized? No, Venerable Sir. Hear, Malankyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed and cognized by you, the sensed. That is explained as seen, heard is number 1, 2, sensed is smelled, tasted and touched, those three senses, all bunged together under sense. So this is still the six senses, but the sensed as those three senses, smelled, tasted and touched. Malankyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed or cognized by you, in the seen there will be merely the seen, in the heard there will be merely the heard, in the sensed there will be merely the sensed, in the cognized there will be merely the cognized. When, Malankyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed and cognized by you, in the seen there will be merely the seen, in the heard there will be merely the heard, in the sensed there will be merely the sensed, and the cognized will be merely the cognized, then, Malankyaputta, you will not be by that. When, Malankyaputta, you're not by that, then you will not be therein. When, Malankyaputta, you're not therein, then you'll be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. This is itself the end of suffering. Off you go. That's what happens when you get a teaching in brief. Do you understand that? So, now first of all, that many of you may know that teaching. In the seen, there's only the seen. In the heard, there'll be only the heard. In the sensed, there'll be only the sensed. In the cognized, there'll be only the cognized. as a very famous teaching of the Buddha Tabahiya. And that is often quoted as a teaching where Bahiya heard this and became enlightened afterwards. In fact, right afterwards, because after hearing that teaching, a cow attacked him, gored him and killed him. And he was enlightened. And people say, wow, you don't need jhana to become enlightened. All you need to make sure is, in the seen is only the seen, in the heard only the heard. In the sense only the sense, in the cognized will be only the cognized. Sounds simple, doesn't it? Can you do that? Now remember the sutta we had before. There the Buddha was telling the same monk that you can't do this without jhana. As for Bahiya, if ever you read an article which I once wrote about that, Bahiya had done jhanas in his past life. He was one of five monks, or seven monks, who went up a mountain, threw down the ladder, and it was really meditate and bust. One became an enlightened, one became an anagami, the rest of them busted. They died up in the mountain. And he got reborn as Bahiya. And eventually he got shipwrecked, and then when he got shipwrecked, he came up with no clothes on the Indian shore. And because he had no clothes, he got some bark. And he wore some bark just to cover himself. And people thought, wow, that's an ascetic. They never realized he was a shipwrecked sailor. They thought he was a holy man, because that's what holy men do in India. They wear hardly anything, or weird stuff. And so because they thought he was a holy man, they started giving him gifts, giving him dana. And he thought, this is much better than working for a living. And so he got, you know, all these nice gifts and honor and fame, and he really got into it, and he got proud, and he thought, wow, you know, I get all this honor and fame just by wearing bark, I must be enlightened. And then his old mate from his previous life, the one who was the anagami, came down and said, look, you're not an arahat, don't get above yourself, you're not even close to being an arahat. And Bahiya said, well, how can I become an arahat? Just is a Buddha living, you know, the other side of India, go and see him. And so he travelled the whole length of India from the west coast into the Ganges Valley in one night. Okay, so the guy had psychic powers. He must have been doing the jhanas. And then that's when he saw the Buddha, and the Buddha gave him the teaching, in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized. He got it straight away. He leapt into it. He got joy in it. He settled in that teaching. And found release, the release of being a fully enlightened being. But in that sutta they don't mention all that other part of the story, which is in other places. And the same Malokyaputta here, I mention the other part of his story where the Buddha taught him about the five lower fetters and how jhana is necessary to do that. So this is why I mention this, because these two have to go together. It's not just hearing the Dhamma and becoming enlightened. Yeah. He was, he had to, it took him a time. As an old man, of course he was. Old men can do jhanas. It's easy, yeah, of course. Okay, as an old person, you've got the pluses and minuses. Now the minuses, you've got a body with inertia. You know what I mean, the pain and sluggishness of the body. But you got the wisdom when your sense desires are nowhere near as strong, when the hormones are raging. So you got a lesser amount of desire. And you've been there and done that and seen that and sensed that. And, you know, your sensory desires are much weaker. They should be anyway. And unless you're what we call the dirty old man syndrome. If you know what I mean, a dirty old woman as well. Let's not be gender specific. That's what they used to call it when I was a kid anyway, but you know what I mean. But, you know, just this is what people are like. But most of them, you've got the pluses there. So, yeah, you've got obstacles of, you know, sickness and sluggishness of body, but the other stuff, you know, you've got, you know, way ahead of the young people. So, you know, sometimes it's hard for a young man to get jhanas when you've got a girlfriend. Can be done though. Okay, so now what people really love, and you know, sometimes people say Theravada, you know, it's not as sort of punchy as Zen. And now here we've got a great Zen sort of koan here. You will not be by that. When you're not by that, you'll not be therein. When Malunki Puti, you're not therein. You'll not be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. What the heck does this mean? He says it's the end of suffering. What it means to be by that is, again, anatta, you're not going to construct your ego, your sense of identity, who you are through the hurts, the seen, the heard, the sensed, or the cognized. Where do you build this illusion of a self? Just on your experiences. So if you can unbuild who you think you are. I am Ajahn Brahm. Why is that? Because, you know, that's a name that's given to me. I read a book, my eyes say, open the door of your heart, Ajahn Brahm. So it's very easy to get a sense of self, you know, through these 5, 6 senses. But when you don't make a sense of self, when it's just the seen, it's just the heard, it's nothing more than that. It's not me seeing. It's not me owning the seeing. It's not me in the seeing. It's not so the seeing, so containing me as a self. Then you're not making a self in it. You're not in that. You're not therein. But when you're not therein, you're not nowhere. It means after death, this is you're neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. You don't get reborn, either back into this place, into another place, or any place in between at all. It's the end of rebirth. When it says neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two, it seems to be that was a standard sort of concept of where you get reborn. Get reborn here in some other realm or some place in between. No rebirth. That's the end of suffering. So it means actually not being reborn, because you're not making a sense of self. There's no one there to be reborn anymore. Any questions on that one? Okay. But Malunki Punta, I understand in detail, Venerable Sir, the meaning of what was stated by the Blessed One in brief. And here he goes, he has a little poem here. And this poem is actually repeated in his Theragata. As you see in the end, he became an arahat, has a happy ending. And because he had a happy ending, you know, his verses are included in the verses of the elder monks who became enlightened, the Theragata. Having seen a form with mindfulness muddled. Mindfulness muddled means, you know, you're not just you're not aware, but you've got no wisdom with your mindfulness. Attending to the pleasing sign, because, you know, you don't know its danger. One experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. You know, my beautiful girlfriend. You know, the wonderful movie when you see something with a pleasing sign. The wonderful dress in the window. The new... What was the iPod? It's an iPlay, or isn't that some? What's the latest gizmo from Apple? iPad. The latest iPad, you see it in the shop. And you're attending to the pleasing sign, and you experience it with infatuated mind, and remain tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible form. Covetousness and annoyance, too. By which one mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having heard a sound with mindfulness muddled, attending to a pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the sound. Covetous and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having smelt an odour with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, dinner's coming. One experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from odours. Covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having enjoyed a taste with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible, from the odour, from the taste, sorry. covetousness, annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having felt a contact with mindfulness muddled, attended to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the touch, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having known an object with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind, remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from knowing, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is far away. But when firmly mindful, one sees a form. One is not inflamed by lust for forms. One experiences it with dispassionate mind and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees the form and while one undergoes a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering, thus Nibbana is said to be close by. When firmly mindful, one hears a sound. When firmly mindful, one smells an odor. When firmly mindful, one enjoys a taste. When firmly mindful, one feels a contact. When firmly mindful, one knows an object. One is not inflamed by lust for such mental objects. One experiences it with dispassionate mind and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees the form and when one sees the knowing, the mind object, and while one undergoes a feeling, suffering is exhausted, it is not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. Now just point out, that's what mindfulness means. Mindfulness is not just, I know this. Because sometimes people say that if you do meditation, then your mindfulness is so strong you can really experience, you can really enjoy your sex. Well, what are you talking about? That's not mindfulness. It's maybe you're aware, but you're forgetting what you're supposed to be doing. It says, when firmly mindful, one sees a form, one's not inflamed by lust for these things. So it's not just mindfulness as knowing. It also knows it so it understands the problems, the dangers, the escapes. It has wisdom with it. That's real mindfulness. Always goes with wisdom. Sometimes in the suttas even, they use mindfulness, but it also means you remember the teachings. Remember what the instructions. You know what you're supposed to be doing. That's real mindfulness. So I just point that out because sometimes people misunderstand that. It is in such a way, Venerable Sir, that I understand in detail the meaning of what was said by the Blessed One in brief. Good, good, Malunkya Purusa. It is good that you understand in detail the meaning of what was stated by me in brief. It is in such a way, Malunkya Purusa, that the meaning of what was stated by me in brief should be understood in detail. Then a Venerable Malunkya Purusa, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Next month, we go on circumambulation. What is circumambulation? Keeping people to the right. That's called dakina. And dakina or daksina in Sanskrit, which in Thai is Thaksin, the former prime minister causing the trouble. That's where he got his name from, dakina. It's actually respect. And actually that's what we do. Padakina is a circumambulation. So that's actually keeping things to its right. And even the Muslims do that when they go on Hajj. They go to the Grand Mosque. They go around it three times. Must have come from Buddhism because it's an Indian tradition. Then the Venerable Malunkya Purusa, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping on his right, departed. Then dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Malunkya Purusa, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen and women rightly go forth from the household life into homelessness. He directly knew, destroyed his birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. No more rebirth. And the Venerable Malunkya Purusa became one of the arahats. A very wonderful, happy ending. So, put those two together, those two suttas, jhanas, overcome the five hindrances, Overcome the five fetters, sorry. I get this wonderful sense of in the seen, only the seen. So you affirm mindfully in such a way that even as one sees these things or experiences them, one undergoes a feeling that suffering is exhausted, nothing is built up, you dismantle suffering that way. And no longer are you going to be reborn. So can you do that? He was an old man, he could do it. One of the nice things is that sometimes people keep on asking you, and they say, well, this is Australia, and you know, this is 21st century, can we become enlightened these days? You know, I didn't get a university degree, you know, I didn't even finish high up in school, and I'm a woman, I'm English, I'm whatever, I wasn't even born in a Buddhist country, oh, what's the chance of me getting this? Malunkya Puta could do this, an old guy. So if he could, you could. So it doesn't depend on your education or even on your health. Can be done. So off you go. I expect good results by next fortnight. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammasambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi savakkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅgho Sāṅgāṁ Namāmi